This program is called Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. I'm Kevin Kelly. We're on every Monday through Friday from 12 to 1. And on today's program, some Civil War era, what they call over-the-shoulder horns. And we'll explain why they are called that. It sounds logical enough, but I was actually surprised when I saw them, just how they're actually played. These come from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music at the University of Illinois. The archivist, Scott Schwartz, is with us, as are five folks to play these instruments for us in our studio live on Live and Local here on FM 90.9. That was a piece of music called The Battle of Shiloh by C.L. Barnhouse from 1888, performed by the New Columbian Brass Band, conducted by George Foreman, not to be confused with the boxer, from a disc, interesting disc of descriptive overtures from America's Golden Age. It's called A Trip to Coney Island. It's on the Dorian Discovery label. And there's lots of, if you like that, there's lots of other things, like an extremely descriptive piece of about the Battle of San Juan Hill that I've used to play on my old show when I was hosting the classical music show in the early morning. I'm Kevin Kelly. This is the new show as of February of this year, called Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And our connection today is with some very interesting looking, and we will soon find out, sounding instruments that Scott Schwartz, who is the archivist for the Sousa Archives at the University of Illinois, has simply called over-the-shoulder horns for reasons that are obvious once we describe them to you. And we've got five folks playing them all here. Tracy Parrish, Rebecca Calpet, Polly Middleton, Maureen Reagan, and Todd Cranson. And also with us, Susan, I'm still trying to call her by her daughter's name, even though I've written down her actual name, Susan Tolson, who's executive director of the Urbana Business Association. Okay, good. She's mouthing it for me because I didn't quite finish writing it down and I always mix up the name of that. In any event, she is here because these over-the-shoulder folks are going to be playing at the Urbana Sweet Corn Festival this very weekend. They're also going to be playing at the upcoming Allerton Music Barn Festival at Allerton Park in Monticello. That is over the Labor Day weekend. So thank you all for coming in and joining us on Live and Local today.
Well, thanks for having us.
Scott.
Yes.
You are the curator of these very interesting-looking instruments. Mm-hmm. Give us an overview of why you have them, what they are, and why you have them, and why they're played over the shoulder.
Okay, well, these are all part of the sax horn family, and there were two varieties, the circular horn where the bell pointed up, and the over-the-shoulder horn where the bell pointed behind you. The military eventually chose the over-the-shoulder horn over the bell-up horn, in part because the soldiers marched behind the musicians, and the military needed the music to get to the soldiers to march to. And for long, 20, 30, 40-mile jaunts, carrying, all of your military gear, the band would play in part to keep your spirit up, whether you were winning or not. And they would actually, in some instances, even go on to the battlefield. The military basically started using them about 1860 to about 1864. Your life expectancy as a musician was usually fairly short, because you have to recognize is the musician who's marching in front of his colleagues with rifles is also standing in front of the opposing forces with their rifles. So your odds of actually collecting a paycheck were pretty thin if you actually got onto the battlefield.
So does that mean that there were backup players for all these instruments on the battlefield?
No, not. Basically, if you played an instrument, you had an opportunity to serve in a regimental band of which your community would put together. And in most instances, when the shooting started, most of the musicians then played the role of ambulance folks to carry the wounded off the battlefield. And occasionally they would pick up a rifle and also shoot. Dodsworth did some of this. Patrick Gilmore is probably the most famous of the bands. I believe it's from Massachusetts. I don't have my notes with me, so I'm equally unprepared to talk today about Patrick Gilmore, but he's the predecessor to John Philip Sousa. And there is a wonderful story about him. When the shooting started, his men were ordered to carry the wounded off the battlefield, and a cannonball burst near Gilmore's head, and he says, "We need to find a wounded soldier." And the story goes that a wounded soldier had just had his thumb shot off, approached them, and so the entire band then escorted the one wounded soldier to the back to be taken care of. Find out kind of a humorous story about how some of the musicians managed to not get shot.
But I'm going to go back to my other question, because I'm still mm-hmm. very curious about this. Mm-hmm. If as you say, the life expectancy of these band folk was short mm-hmm. because they were marching in the front, and mm-hmm. one of them got shot, which is what the reason you're saying the life expectancy was short,
mm-hmm.
who took their place?
No one.
Oh, okay. Well, that,
so your band eventually became thinned out until there was no band at all.
In which case, they better start winning on their own, because they weren't going to get a lot of inspiration from the band.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look, of course, your audience is listening, can't see the horns, but you have the soprano cornets, little tiny things that not much to hide behind. And, of course, Todd at the far end is playing the tuba, which would be my choice to play if I were marching with these bands, because, quite frankly, at least the odds are that you could hide behind part of that.
But how well it would stop a cannonball is really questionable.
Not much.
Particularly
be
since
more visible.
Yes.
You'd be more visible, and especially since the big part is behind your head. Mm-hmm. You know, by then it's too late, right? Your head is gone.
Well, yeah. Well, you can see why the life expectancy of the horns themselves. I mean, by 1864, they discontinue using the over-shoulder horns. The bands are no longer playing on the field. The military begins to disband them. They're not cost-effective. Better to have soldiers who are, you know, shooting as opposed to playing tunes and getting shot at.
And if you want to have a band and keep it, you better just put them in a room and have them play concerts and things.
Well, yeah. Yes.
Which was what most of these folks are used to playing.
Mm-hmm.
Before we talk too much further about various questions that one could ask, why don't we hear what exactly we're talking about? These are five instruments now. What do you call it? Soprano what? Soprano, just soprano saxhorn?
Yeah. They're all part of the cornet family.
Okay. And then we have the alto and the tenor and the bass. Mm-hmm. Tracy Parrish and Rebecca Calput, who I know are both trumpet players, happen to be playing the soprano. Polly, what do you play normally?
I play the French horn.
Oh, good for you. Well, that's was my instrument. Polly is on the alto, and Maureen, I know, plays the euphonium. I have heard her play that quite often, as a matter of fact, and very well, is on the tenor. Todd, what are you normally?
Tuba,
logically enough, playing the bass horn. And these are instruments from the Sousa Archives at the University of Illinois, playing here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Thank you. So who wants to tell us what that tune was and where it came from? Todd is waving his hand.
Well, that was the Union March. It was the title that it was published under, but it was written as the first inaugural march for President Abraham Lincoln in 1861 when he became president in Washington, D.C. And the composer is Francis Scala, who was at the time the band leader of the president's, or at the time just the Marine Band in Washington, D.C.
Before it was called the President's Own, which Correct. Is what you were about to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is not necessarily the sort of piece that would be played in battle formation, or might it have been?
No, I don't think it would have been.
I mean, not this one, obviously.
This one,
it was
no,
inaugural march, but
no.
very different kind of music.
I think this one would fall in the category of a grand march. Mm-hmm. And a grand march, for instance, at balls, was the first piece on the program. And it's when all the dignitaries and everyone on down came in order of their sort of aristocracy
ranking. Yeah,
ranking, however you want to say that.
Yeah.
And it was the opportunity for everyone to see who was there and to be seen.
And Todd, how do you know all this?
Well, I've been researching this with Scott and things like that, but also I'm from Springfield and I work at the University of Illinois Springfield. And I direct a band called the Vintage Brass Band, and this is the kind of music that we specialize
uh-huh.
in playing, is historic American brass band music.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, I was very curious because not everybody runs around picking up this kind of information, and if you do, there must be some reason for it.
Well, living in Springfield, we have certainly done a lot for the Lincoln Bicentennial.
And, sure you have.
I actually came to Scott about 2 years ago now, with the title of the next one that we were going to play, which is titled The Mary Polka, telling him that I'd heard of its existence and couldn't find it. And he took a trip to Washington, D.C., researching other things, but then came back with the copies of Francis Scala's handwritten parts for not only the Mary Polka, but also this Union March, the inaugural march for Abraham Lincoln's first inauguration.
Okay, so Scott, I know that you have an intimate connection with Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. because you came to the Sousa Archives from the Smithsonian Institution.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, when somebody like Todd comes to you with a question like that, what's your method of pursuit to find this music that he was after?
Well, I was already aware that the Francis Maria Scala materials were at the Library of Congress. It was just a matter of just going there and using their archives, and it took quite a while to find the actual parts. I actually confess it was not too successful the day I was there, but a colleague at the library was able to then find the box that had gone AWOL and sent me the copies. But in essence, it took three people to find the original parts and then Todd to actually put them to modern notation so we could actually hear it played today.
Now, what do you mean by modern notation as opposed to what?
Well, if you look at Francis Maria Scala's notation, it's pretty crude. I mean, he's writing at a time. Well, the best way to describe it is, you know, your note heads tend to be on either side of the line. You can't tell if it's a 16th or an 8th. His idea of rests is non-existent, just a scratch on a page, and you just count up how many beats are in the measure, and you kind of figure, okay, what he must meant this to be, you know, a quarter rest. And so you begin to kind of have to transcribe his form of notation, a little different from Sousa, which was more classically trained and much easier to read.
So it was kind of like translating shorthand.
Mm-hmm. I think Scala frequently worked on a deadline, because the more and more of his music that I try to bring into modern notation, if that's what we want to call it, the more and more I find he must have been in a hurry. And also, I think that it could have been one of the reasons why Sousa was such a huge splash, in addition to being good. I think that Scala was frequently working in a hurry and overlooked things, and he clearly has wrong notes in there, which the more and more time I spend with all these wrong notes of Scala's and other collections of this music, the more I think that these musicians, you know, they weren't watching TV in their spare time, so they were spending a ton of time with this music, and the musicians probably just played it correctly despite what was on the page.
Yes, and I think you're right about the I mean, Lincoln often would have the Marine Band play at the White House. He loved the music, and in the Scala materials, there are little notes, almost the size of a business card. You've been requested to appear at the White House, and he would just sign Lincoln, and that would be then carried to the Marine Band, and they would be expected that night to play. And I suspect probably sometimes with a new tune. So, yes, very much under a deadline.
Yeah, that would certainly do it. We should tell listeners that you're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. Live in the studio with us are five performers on over-the-shoulder horns from a particular collection, which we will ask Scott Schwartz about in a little bit. Scott Schwartz is archivist for the University of Illinois' Sousa Archives and Center for American Music. And support for today's broadcast comes in part from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. And information is at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Scott, this collection of instruments these five instruments belong to a much larger collection.
That is correct,
called
yes.
The Carl Busch Papers and Music Instrument Collection, according to your very own website. And I noticed that one of our performers here wrote up this collection, Tracy Parrish, who is with us as well. Which one of you guys would like to talk about the Carl Busch collection?
We should let Dr. Tracy speak in the authoritative role he played in getting this collection processed.
And let me suggest that for those of you who are playing, we have sort of an odd microphone set up here. If you could, when you do speak, come a little closer to the microphone. That'll make it easier on our sound guy.
Well, I suppose I should first tell you who Carl Busch was. He was originally from Denmark. He was the conductor of the Kansas City Symphony Orchestra. He passed away, I believe, in the 40s. And he left his collection actually to the University of Illinois, probably because of his relationship with Albert Austin Harding. And the collection consists not only of these instruments, but also of clarinets, flutes, a lot of other brass instruments, Antonio foam, which is something like a baritone. So he left us quite a few interesting instruments, also some more primitive instruments, more basic drums and that sort of thing that would have been handmade by people in North America during the late 19th, early 20th century. So it's a very large collection, and he also has quite a few photographs of himself and a lot of his colleagues, lots of famous conductors and performers, military band conductors, those sorts of people from that period in American history. So it's a really large collection with a broad reach, but the instrument collection is most interesting, I think. And like I said, those instruments span from probably the late 18th century through the early 20th century. So we have some clarinets we have one clarinet, I believe, in the collection that was made something around the 10 years after Mozart wrote his clarinet concerto in A. So you can kind of see the progression of these instruments in terms of how they're built through history. So you could see in these old clarinets, for instance, that the keys are handmade and they're just hammered out of brass or nickel, whatever. And then you can kind of see the transition into new key systems, manufactured keys, changes in the kind of wood that they use, and that's just one example if you want to do research on instruments, for instance. So it's a very interesting collection.
How many of these over-the-shoulder instruments are in that collection?
Was it about 15, 10 to 15?
No, closer to 20, although some of them, I mean, the horns we're listening to today, many of them we've gotten back into playing condition. I mean, you have to imagine these, the over-the-shoulder horns date from about 1859 to 1864, so, you know, well over 100 years. Marines tenor is not behaving quite so well. You play the horns and a new quirk comes along, you know, either it misaligns or a ferrule begins to leak. So we're constantly having to repair these.
When you're 150 years old, you may have some
more than plenty. It's an interesting collection with many of the instruments still functional, and we're continually restoring them as we continue to work on the collection, improving access. It's a great opportunity to check out instruments that, quite frankly, you'd find maybe sometimes stapled to a wall in a restaurant. In this instance, you know, we're thankful that they're not. They're fully playable.
Well, I'm actually glad you mentioned Maureen Thorne, because I, you know, had taken a moment to say I've heard her play, and she plays wonderfully, and then she suddenly is having this thing that won't cooperate right, and all these weird sounds are kind of coming out of it.
I'm just relieved it's the horn.
Yes.
Were you doubting yourself? During
Absolutely.
Well, that is the thing about playing, well, any wind instrument or any instrument at all, but I think especially brass instruments, sometimes you can be so psyched out to play these things. If something wrong happens, I mean, your first assumption is, it must be me. Mm-hmm. And so that's nice to have these ancient things where you can blame them a lot more easily than your standard trumpet, horn, trombone, or tuba or whatever.
Oh, one of the things that, you know, we want our collections to be played, I mean, because you can't really learn about the instrument from a textbook. And quite frankly, it's fun to watch students who have only played modern instruments to just play one of these much older horns and suddenly realize, how did Herbert L. Clark do that? I mean, I can play his Carnival of Venice on a modern horn. It's a bear to play. But I play on his horn, and how do I do it? He must have been a truly grand musician to be able to make the sounds that he did. So it helps bring some reality to the history of music in these particular instruments also.
Let's bring that some more of that reality to bear. Mm-hmm. So, Todd, you sort of introduced the next piece. Do you want to retell us what it is?
Sure. The title is the Mary Polka, or Mary Todd Polka, depending where you looked. And the first party that the Lincolns threw in the White House, Mary Lincoln requested Scala to write her a polka, which was the dance craze at the time. And this is my arrangement of what he gave her.
Okay. Thank you. Polka, or the Mary Todd Polka, as in Mary Todd Lincoln, here on FM 90.9, played on some over-the-shoulder horns from the Sousa Archives at the University of Illinois, on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our program is made possible in part by Parkland Art Gallery at Parkland College, seeking to expand appreciation of various art forms, promote the development of artists' talent, and encourage aesthetic awareness. The gallery's exhibitions and educational programs are offered free of charge to the public. And Parkland Art Gallery is the new sponsor of our calendar here on Live and Local, and I do have a few items on it. We'll peek ahead to the weekend for a specific reason in just a moment. But tonight, if you are a theatrical type, there are open auditions for The Pajama Game being performed by Theater 7 in Decatur at the Decatur Civic Center. Those auditions begin at 6:30 tonight. I actually don't have anything on my calendar for tomorrow, but that doesn't mean there isn't anything. I think that there are some things I noticed in the paper that just didn't make it here. And by the paper, I mean any of a number of area newspapers. On Thursday, dancer Philip Johnston and colleagues is presenting a program called Step Into the Music at the Mills Breast Cancer Institute on the main Carl Clinic campus in Urbana. That is a free show for about an hour beginning at noon on Thursday. And Conklin's Barn 2 Dinner Theater in Goodfield is presenting Unnecessary Farce. That's Thursday through Saturday at 6 o'clock and then Sunday at noon. Looking ahead to Saturday, it's the Urbana Sweet Corn Festival in downtown Urbana, starting at 11 in the morning and going till 11 at night. And I jumped ahead specifically to that because you can hear some of these old over-the-shoulder horns and more. Or is this the group, Scott, that will be playing at the Sweet Corn Festival?
This will be one of many groups they'll be playing. They'll be playing actually starting at 10 o'clock as part of the Bell Tower dedication. We kind of kick it off at 9 o'clock with the dedication. My family will be playing
the Schwartz Family Band.
At 10 o'clock, the quintet here will be playing at the courthouse to gather attention for the bell tower and the new museum space. And from there, I've asked them if they'd be willing to then march to the Broadway stage to really kick off the first Broadway stage group at 11, which is Robin Kirton's Bodacious String Band, and to kind of draw the crowd from the courthouse to the Broadway stage. Early on, you'll have an opportunity to hear the band play a variety of tunes from a period when the bell tower may have been actually considered for construction.
And actually, the Sweet Corn Festival, I skipped over the Friday part, starts at 5 o'clock on Friday, runs till 11. With us here also on the show is Susan Tolson, who, and I almost called you Kirby again. Kirby is her daughter, but I because it was about to come out, is director of the Urbana Business Association, and came along to just give us an overview of at least the musical parts of the Urbana Sweet Corn Festival, and there's a lot of that.
There is an awful lot. I think by the time we added it all up, we have over 20 different musical opportunities on a two-day festival, so thanks for the pickup. Although, Kevin, I know you've worked with my daughter, Kirby. I do answer to Kirby's mom. I'm used to that. I still get that, even in my job, and I answer to that as well. So we're super excited to have, the horns playing. We've partnered with a number of different organizations to make the Sweet Corn Festival, I think, even richer this year. And a brand new partnership is with the University of Illinois. And that came from a crazy coffee date with Scott trying to figure out a way to bring him into the mix because, as Todd was indicating, I think those of us who know Scott, he's Mr. Resourceful. And he's your go-to guy. So if there is an idea that can be elaborated and make happen, I am now 100% convinced you are the matrix of Champaign County on that angle. So Scott hooked us up with some Chris Campbell, and at that point she was with the University for Public Engagement. And now we've been working with some staff there, and we've got this partnership. It's the One Community Together stage is what we're calling the stage on North Broadway. And that is the stage that's north of Main Street on Broadway, and there'll be this gorgeous banner that says One Community Together. Because really, at the end of the day, I really want to look at Sweet Corn as that umbrella and welcome as many partnerships that make sense to come aboard and play and give it as rich of an opportunity as possible. Now, the U of I is having the College of Engineering, and there will be interactive opportunities there all day on Saturday starting at 11 a.m. CU Fit Families, which is really kind of being owned, I guess, by the Family Resiliency Center at the University of Illinois. And then the College of ACES. And they have got some, again, interactive activities for the whole family starting at 11 a.m. I'm going to allow Scott to elaborate on the special music that will be brought to you by the University of Illinois that I think kind of ties the string around all the different multiple organizations that really make Champaign County an amazing place to live.
Yeah, I mean, when we think of Champaign County, I had asked Susan, can we focus on the many special collections that we have here? It's not just sports and, you know, and great pubs to drink at. I mean, we have great repositories. And I said, is there some way to connect our great music, local musicians, with these repositories in some way to highlight what is so cool about our community? And, you know, for example, beginning at 11 o'clock, we have the Bodacious String Band with Robin Kirtan directing. And we're tying that with the Early American Museum and highlighting what they're doing there. So we tie the ensemble together with the, you know, the group. We have Nathaniel Banks, Mo Better Jazz, another youth ensemble, different type of music. And we're focusing on, you know, the planetarium, the Rantoul Air Museum. And so, you know, from the 12:15 to 12:45 time slot, we'll be focusing on music and, you know, that type of special collection group. We have the Robert E. Brown Center for World Music. We're bringing music from New Guinea and Bali. We're doing that on stage, and we're focusing on the Spurlock Museum. So the Spurlock Museum's collections and the World Music Center to just bring those together. We have the Boneyard Jazz Quintet. It'll be playing from 2:30 to 3:15. And they'll be playing a variety of, you know, basically big band swing music and tying to several of the other types of repositories. And then Prairie Dogs, and then we've got Big Grove Zydeco. So all of these bands are all local, and we're really emphasizing this connection, this symbiosis between our musicians and our special collections in a way that hadn't been done in the past. So we're one community together.
Yeah, that sounds like a great approach to doing something a little different.
And, you know, after Big Grove Zydeco, I'm really
excited. Oh, yeah, I forgot about this.
I mean, this is, to me, this has been something that I just keep thinking about, that if you think you know Sweet Corn, you got to make sure you're here at 6:15. You got to make sure you're here Friday and Saturday. But at 6:15 at the Broadway stage.
On Saturday.
On Saturday, correct. Thank you, Kevin. We will have, we're so excited to have the Illini Marching Band with us and joining us and preceding them.
The whole marching band.
The whole marching band.
All 300 of them. And whoa, every little detail down to corn and water has been addressed. So we've got them all. And director Peter Griffin is so unflappable. Mm-hmm. I kept thinking of any obstacle that can get in his way. And he was like, oh, no, that's not a problem. So we are really excited to get those to the Illini Marching Band. And with them, we have both mayors. We have Mayor Pressing. We have Mayor Schweikart. Chancellor Herman will be there as well. So picture this. You're on North Broadway. Big Grove ends. You have a marching band coming out, all right, all 300 of them, marching south on Broadway, turning east on Elm, right behind the county courthouse, marching them to our main stage at the Champaign County Courthouse parking lot, the Miller main stage. They will assemble, and it's neat because how often do you get a chance to listen to the Illini Marching Band if you're not at one of the football games? So they will assemble for about a 15-20 minute set, and then you'll have some remarks from the mayors and from Chancellor Herman as well. So it's going to be something. I mean, something I think everybody will remember. If you've been to Sweet Corn, you know how crowded we are, but Peter Griffin, director Peter Griffin, is going to get his amazing, talented 300 Illini marching band to march through the chaos. And it'll be an exciting moment, I think.
It sounds like you made it sound very dramatic. It also made me think, get out of the way of the onslaught of all those people.
And that's what Director Griffin said. He said, people will move. When they see 300 of us, they will clear a path. So mm-hmm. I trust that he has done this a time or two, and I think we're in really good hands.
And so, if not, I'm sure they'll have spiked shoes to just make sure that...
and hopefully we don't have the horns marching out any wounded afterwards.
Yeah, will these guys be in front of the marching band, leading the marching band?
Actually, guys,
picking up the wounded, yeah.
Nah.
I think the only wounded we're going to have is from too much funnel cakes or something like that. I think we're in good hands.
I think so. It's an exciting opportunity. Very different Sweet Corn this year. And that we're real excited.
And we actually have Illinois Sweet Corn this year, and we are still selling
really?
It. Really? The growing season helped. It's all about when is the corn being planted. And we kind of had a cooler, wetter spring, so it delayed things. And this year, we had to go north, but Harvard, Illinois is the farm that will be providing 30,000 ears of sweet corn. Now, imagine this. We'll start cooking on Friday. It will be picked on Thursday because we want it to be as fresh as possible. And we our headliner on Saturday night is War, and that's a band that I'm dating myself that I remember listening to Low Rider as a kid and Cisco Kid. So, it's a free festival, one community together, and there's a little something for everybody. And we appreciate Scott's help and having the horns with us on that day as well.
Well, if you're going to have a band called War, then you really have to guys have these guys as the warm-up band.
Hey, I'm game if you all are game. I don't know how long you were planning on staying that night, but we can definitely fit them in, I'm thinking. So.
I don't want to upstage Pete's band. I think, the marching Illini, that definitely the highlight of the Broadway stage.
Mm-hmm. Susan Tolson is director of the Urbana Business Association and here to talk about the Urbana Sweet Corn Festival happening this weekend from 5 to 11 on Friday, from 11 to 11 on Saturday, although the festivities apparently start at 9 o'clock.
At 9 a.m., we were approached by the Champagne Clock and Bell Tower Committee to dedicate the beautiful, if you haven't been in downtown Urbana, that beautiful new clock and bell tower, which is just gorgeous, and you can see coming off on Vine Street heading south. They will dedicate that at 9 a.m. There are dignitaries, and there's going to be a nice performance. The Schwartz Family Band will be there. And then until noon, there is a little gem housed there, and it is the Abraham Lincoln Large Presence in a Small Town, and it's this awesome interactive exhibit. And if you've been to the Lincoln Museum in Springfield, it is of that vein, that interactive kind of vein. And it talks about Lincoln's presence here in Urbana, which was quite prominent, which I was unaware of. So the tours will begin right after at 10, from 10 until noon. So really, this year, just come on out at 9 a.m. Just make it a full day, 9 to 11, and there's enough sugar to be sold that'll just keep you
sure
going.
There is. I'm sure there is. Well, we have with us on Live and Local today also the group of over-the-shoulder horns played by Tracy Parrish, Rebecca Calpit, Polly Middleton, Maureen Reagan, and Todd Cranson. What is our next tune, folks? Somebody volunteer to introduce.
Yes.
They're all gesturing to each other.
Next tune's title is Hail Columbia. It was in the running for the national anthem, but it lost. And it is now used to announce the Vice President of the United States. This is the first of three tunes we have today that is music actually from the Sousa Archives in their collection. It's actually also from the Coral Bush Collection. And the books are from a band that existed in Humboldt, Kansas. And there was a Civil War musician who, upon finishing his time, he survived.
Mm-hmm.
Upon finishing his time in the military, he went back home to Humboldt, Kansas, and immediately started up a town band. And that town band was known as the Humboldt Brass Band. And back then, this was before published music, before there really was access to it widely. And so all the music in their collection was handwritten in part books. And Carl Busch somehow got a hold of them and preserved them. And now they've made it all the way to the Sousa Archives, who's still preserving them. And we have a little selection of music to perform from this. So the first one is Hail Columbia.
Played here on Live and Local on FM 90.9 from the Humboldt collection, which is in the Carl Busch collection, which is in the Sousa Archives, which is curated by Scott Schwartz, who is with us today along with these fine players on Live and Local. A couple of questions about the horns themselves and about their upkeep, because I was thinking of Minnie Pearl, for those who knew who Minnie Pearl was in country music fame, who always had the price tag on her hat. And these guys all look like they have price tags on their horns, but I presume that those are identifying labels of some kind or another.
Yeah, these are the accession numbers for each one of the horns. Museum artifacts are assigned a distinct accession number to separate them. And so these horns will have not only a number assigned to them, but any of the extraneous parts, mouthpieces and so forth, so that they're kept together as a single unit. So, yeah, they do look like mini pearls. Kind of.
And they're also all playing them wearing white gloves, mm-hmm. I presume also for reason having to do with the care and upkeep.
Yes. Bottom line is we do require all the musicians who play our horns to wear gloves just to keep the oils from damaging the instruments. If you look at some of them, they are quite tarnished. For the tuba that Todd's playing, you can see clearly where the hand held the instrument all along the larger portion of the bell. All of the lacquer is completely removed, and so the idea is to try not to add any more damage to the horns.
And how difficult are some of these to play? I mean, we talked a little bit about the
It all depends on the day.
The problem. Well, Scott referred to some things lining up. I mean, just for in case anybody wonders, you know, what's the problem with these things? These all mostly have rotary valves, it looked like, right?
That's correct. They're using the patent string rotary valve, which is purely an American rotary valve design. The patent string technique or model was created so that you could quickly realign your valve in the field by just unscrewing one or two of the screws with your pocket knife, pulling the string taut, and then tightening it back down. The German rotary valve is a crank action. Looks like a Swiss clock. When that gets out of alignment, you basically have to take it to somebody to do the work. So these were really meant to be fixed in the field. If you had a problem, you did it yourself.
But that is the trick. If something comes loose and the inside of that, because the inside of the valve, there's a hole lined up with all of the slides. You always see mm-hmm. these curlicue things on trumpets, horns, trombones, tubas, and so on. If it doesn't line up, that's when you get problems. Mm-hmm. And that's probably what's going on.
A little bit like a duck call.
Yep.
Like a duck call.
Duck call, yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's have, Todd, I know you said you've got a couple of more tunes, and then I want to be sure we talk a little bit about the Allerton Music Barn
sure.
Festival, because that's a special concert on the 4th of September. What's next? Is this from the same collection then?
Yes, the next tune is titled Red, White, and Blue. Next title is Red, White, and Blue. And the significance of us playing Hail Columbia and Red, White, and Blue is that in 1876 there was a newspaper account of the Humboldt Band playing for the 4th of July celebration, and it specifically mentioned these two tunes by name, and we got them from the actual book, so you're hearing the 100 years of America right here.
Okay. A truly historic occasion.
Yes.
I definitely knew, for certain. That's always a great tune to hear. The Allerton Music Barn Festival is running from the 3rd of September through the 7th, and on Friday the 4th, the concert in the evening is called the American Brass Band Journal circa 1853, with marches, waltzes, quick steps, schottisches, and national airs. That's at 8:30 on Friday the 4th, and it features a lot of folks, mostly from the faculty at the University of Illinois, on that concert. Scott, what can you tell us about that program?
It basically focusing on Dodsworth's Brass Band Journal. It's an opportunity for the faculty, and we have several new faculty at the School of Music, to play the horns. Rob Rumbelow, who is the new University Bands Director, he will not officially start until January, but he's coming to campus early part of September to conduct this concert. So it'll be an opportunity for people to, see Rob in action. And of course, it's hardly fair. He works with modern instruments, and here we've thrown at him, Civil War instruments. All of the horns will be, basically pre- and post-Civil War horns, with the exception of the drum, which we're borrowing from a colleague, which is a recreation of a historic drum. And it's a great opportunity to hear all of the types of music that would have been played during the Civil War era. I'm giving a lecture on the sax horn just to talk about, this odd piece of plumbing that the military, took advantage of for a short period of time and then bailed on. And that lecture begins at 6:30 and will go for about 30, 40 minutes.
And will you have these guys there doing a demonstration of the instruments?
We'll have some of the folks there. We'll have, of course, it depends on the dress rehearsal and how the horns are behaving. I'd like to have two or three horns so people can actually hear them played during my lecture. And we'll have plenty of opportunity after the concert for people to actually come up and look at the horns and ask each one of the performers questions.
But not touch them without a white-gloved finger.
That is correct, yes. If you don't have white gloves, you can't play the horns.
What if you have black gloves?
I think we could probably work with that.
Okay.
Kevin, are you going to be bringing your black gloves with us?
I might look for some red gloves.
Excellent.
Except I know I don't have any, so that's a hopeless cause right there. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. Our programs are made possible with support from Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com. And we have time for one more tune, also from the Humboldt Collection. Todd, any introduction required?
The title of this tune is The Baseball Quick Step. And I did a little looking to learn about the history of baseball and the time of this tune, and baseball had been around a little longer than this tune, but I think it had reached Humboldt, Kansas.
Over-the-shoulder horns from the Carl Busch Collection at the Sousa Archives on the University of Illinois. The archivist is Scott Schwartz, has been with us today on Live and Local, and the performers playing on soprano horns, Tracy Parrish and Rebecca Calput, on alto horn, Polly Middleton, on tenor, Maureen Reagan, and on bass, Todd Cranson, who has also been the one introducing the various tunes, and Susan Tolson, Executive Director of the Urbana Business Association, with us as well to talk about the Sweet Corn Festival in Urbana, where these folks will be performing on Saturday. And, of course, the festival goes on Friday evening and on Saturday. I'm Kevin Kelly for Live and Local. On tomorrow's show, Carl Kramer, who is director of the University of Illinois School of Music, will be here to talk about the complete Allerton Music Barn Festival and whatever else comes up in that conversation, and play some of his own selections of music on the program. That's from 12 to 1. Tomorrow. In just a minute, we'll have a weather forecast. At a minute past one, we'll have news headlines from NPR, and Julie Amacher is in with classical music for you at 106. Thanks to everybody for joining us on the program today. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly.